The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1996, a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine wrote an article attacking the idea that recycling could solve America's prolific production of garbage. Recycling may be the most wasteful activity in modern America, he wrote, a waste of time and money, and a waste of human and natural resources. That writer was John Tierney, and his claims that recycling was garbage were excoriated as too harsh and too early to judge. Nearly two decades later, John Tierney has written another piece for the Sunday Times and concludes that recycling in America is still an unsustainable model for reducing waste and carbon emissions. John Tierney is co-author of Willpower and writes the column Findings for the Science Times section of the New York Times and joins us now to discuss the reign of recycling, as he put it. John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So this is a very detailed and considered argument, but can you give me your kind of elevator pitch for why recycling is not worth it?
Recycling typically costs more than it does to landfill the trash. And while it makes sense to recycle some things like paper, cardboard, and metals, most of the other stuff in garbage is not worth recycling. It's expensive and it doesn't do much for the environment.
Okay, so it doesn't actually cut down on waste either?
Well, it cuts down on waste, but to me that's not a great goal in and of itself. The recycling movement began back in the 70s with the idea that we're running out of all these natural resources. And then it was heightened in the 80s by the fear that we're running out of space to bury our garbage. Both of these fears have not been borne out. There's plenty of room to bury garbage in environmentally safe landfills. We're not running out of these resources. There's no particular need. We have to save them. And the most precious resource we have, I think, is our time. That's the one resource that really gets more expensive through time. Natural resources tend to get cheaper, and I think we're wasting a lot of time and energy, you know, training children to sort garbage and, you know, giving sermons on recycling. And, you know, we should recycle the stuff that makes sense, and we shouldn't worry about the rest.
So people should feel relief hearing this, but people are angry. I remember actually reading your article back in 96. Distinctly remember arguing with a friend who agreed with you. I was and continued to be an avid recycler. And I was angry. I just didn't want to accept it. Why is there an emotional response to this?
Well, for some people, recycling really, it feels like the moral thing to do. One shouldn't waste. And there's this intuitive belief that this is doing some good for the community, for the environment. And to me, recycling seems very much like a religion, and it's very hard to dissuade people from religious beliefs. And I certainly respect, you know, people's feelings on this. And if people want to recycle, if it makes them feel good, and there are actually some studies that, you know, that many people will pay extra money to recycle. And that's fine. I don't want to interfere with anyone's right to do that. What I do think, though, is that it's not right to force everyone else to follow your religion, and it's not right to force taxpayers and communities to pay a higher price for something that is basically a religious ritual.
So you mentioned that it is more expensive to recycle, but what about the market for selling recyclables? Does that help offset the cost?
Well, that was the belief in the beginning. When New York City began recycling, it projected it was going to save money because it would, you know, basically be able to sell all this valuable stuff in garbage. In fact, that just hasn't happened. New York City, since it started in 1992, is probably spent more than $1 billion extra dollars on recycling. That if we just put it in the landfill, it would have been that much cheaper. Now, as I say, some things, paper and cardboard and metal, they can be collected without too much trouble, and there is a market for reselling that stuff. But most of the other things, there just isn't that much of a market for, and it's fairly difficult to recycle. Glass is really is terrible to recycle because it breaks, it damages the recycling machinery, it contaminates all the other material. And then once you separate it out, all these broken pieces of glass, you're left with something that is worthless, that you have to pay someone to take it off your hands. It's really, you know, it's a net loss.
But what happens to all of that plastic? Will that just sit in landfills for the next thousands of years?
Right, but that's good. I mean, it's basically, there's carbon in that. You're basically, it's a way of sequestering carbon in it. I mean, that plastic essentially was sitting in the ground as petroleum before. It's been taken out, you know, put to some use, and then it goes back into the ground. And in some ways, plastic is better to put in a landfill than other things because it doesn't degrade. I mean, one of the disadvantages of landfills is that organic material in there, it decomposes and it turns into methane, which is a greenhouse gas. And that is an objection to landfilling, but landfill operators have started capturing that methane and using it to generate electricity. But plastic doesn't cause that problem at all. So, you know, putting plastic in the ground isn't bad, but it's also, you can also incinerate it, as countries in Northern Europe and Japan do. They're very high-temperature, modern incineration plants that release very few pollutants. I mean, there are people that live next door to them. There are parks on top of them, I think, or right next to them. And that's not a bad thing to do with plastic.
Right, because I think often it ends up in waterways, too. I mean, we hear about the great garbage patch in the ocean, for example. It breaks down in teeny little pieces. Is it less likely to end up in the ocean if it is more likely to end up in a landfill, for example?
Well, it's not going to get from a landfill to the ocean. So, I mean, the problem is people that throw stuff on the ground. And it's been shown that that if you want to reduce litter, you're better off doing that directly rather than trying to, you know, do a recycling or use deposits on bottles. That, you know, places that have the cleanest highways are places that actually spend money collecting litter rather than places with bottle deposits and things like that. Mm. And, you know, part of the problem with recycling is, I mean, when New York City started its program, it thought it was going to save money. It was more expensive, and so New York City had to cut back on street cleaning to make up for that budget shortfall. So in that sense, there was probably more trash on the streets that might have ended up in streams somehow.
We're speaking with John Tierney, who writes for the New York Times Science Times and wrote an article, a follow-up of sorts, to a 1996 piece he wrote about the wasted time, energy, and money of recycling. He has cycled back around and found, again, that it is an unsustainable business model and not really that good for the environment. Well, why are cities and towns increasing curbside recycling efforts, even adding curbside composting to the mix in some cases, if it is more expensive to sustain?
Well, because it's politically appealing to do. There's strong pressure from special interests, which are environmental groups, that they're lobbying for it. It feels like a good thing to say. Who can be in favor of waste? And the population has been so indoctrinated in it by both, you know, teachers through school and also the media have just covered recycling pretty much uncritically. I mean, when I wrote about it in 1996, the economists I talked to weren't surprised by this at all because, you know, they'd always assumed that this activity must have some problems. And it's certainly not true that it's good to recycle one material, you should therefore recycle everything. But this news shocked everyone else because no one in the media ever really wrote about this critically. So people have that assumption that it's just inherently good, and they don't realize how much it costs, and they don't realize how little good much of this stuff is really doing.
In your article, you write that a modern, well-lined landfill in a rural area can have relatively little environmental impact. But how about places like, you know, more densely populated New York City or Boston area up here in New England, where the trash will have to be trucked out? And therefore, you're back with the idea of letting more carbon into the air.
Well, the life cycle calculations take all that into account. I mean, when I cited that in the article, these life cycle calculations about what you do, I mean, recyclables have to be trucked around, too. I mean, there are extra trucks on the road to pick them up, and it depends where you live. All this stuff really depends on local economics. And in some places, it's sensible to recycle stuff rather than landfill. But it all depends on local economics. And one of the big fallacies of the recycling movement is the idea there should be a national goal for recycling or there should be a statewide goal. It really depends on the local situation. If landfill space is really scarce, then recycling makes more sense, or it makes more sense to build an incinerator, which is really a lot simpler. The problem with incinerators really is that they're fairly expensive by comparison with landfills. But they make more sense in urban areas where it's harder to get to. But New York City doesn't have any landfills. We send our stuff often by rail or by truck or by barge, and it goes to these communities that are prospering economically because of these landfills. I mean, I visited a place in Virginia that, you know, the landfill, they had just gorgeous new schools, cause, you know, and a new auditorium. They had much nicer schools than New York City has because they were making a fortune off this landfill. And it was tucked back in the woods. You didn't really know it was there, and it was a win-win.
John, you call it a religion, but there's a kind of awareness or consciousness that comes with it. I'm wondering if there's a danger of giving people a pass to do nothing to be aware of the environment. You know, people could run with this and say, see, recycling was pointless, a big waste of taxpayer money. Let's do nothing.
Well, I think you could argue both ways here. I think people feel that if they recycle, that, you know, therefore they've atoned for their sins. And as I mentioned in the article, that it takes recycling 40,000 plastic bottles to make up for one transatlantic plane trip. I mean, the big things that have greenhouse impacts are plane trips, country homes, but people think that if they recycle, well, then it's okay that I did this other stuff because I recycled.
Mm-hmm.
And the other point I would say is that the values it teaches are not values that I want my kid to learn. I understand some people like those values, and I respect that. But I went to a third-grade science class that had spent their entire week studying garbage, and they were convinced that this was this huge problem, that the Earth was going to turn into a giant garbage dump unless they recycled every single thing. And I didn't like seeing them be scared that way, and I didn't like seeing them spend a whole week of science class studying garbage. I don't want my kids, you know, studying garbage. And I don't like teaching kids that, you know, their time is worth less than this garbage, that they should be spending a lot of valuable time thinking about garbage. I want him to learn about the uplifting things in life, real science.
Is that the alternative to recycling for, as you put it, I think, in the article, socially conscious, sensible persons?
I think that the simplest way to solve this would be to put the equivalent of a carbon tax on garbage. And one economist who's looked at all the environmental and social impacts of landfilling and recycling has calculated that if you put a $15 tax per ton on garbage that goes to a landfill, that would offset the social cost, the environmental cost. And I think if communities, you know, did that, you could devote the revenue from that to doing something to reduce carbon emissions, then people could choose in their community which materials make sense to recycle and which ones don't, instead of setting these arbitrary goals and feeling it's a moral responsibility. It's really more of an economic question, and I think that it's better to treat it that way.
Well, John, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Tierney, he's co-author of the best-selling book, Willpower. He writes the findings column for the Science Times section of the New York Times. And you'll find a link to read his opinion piece from the Sunday Review, The Reign of Recycling. There's a link at our website at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Ganges River begins in the Himalayan town of Deprayag, and after 1,560 miles, empties into the Bay of Bengal. It is the world's third largest river based on river flow and is estimated to support 10% of the world's population through agriculture, drinking water, bathing, and as a source of food. The Ganges is also one of the most polluted rivers in the world. At the heart of the problem is that many Hindus believe that being placed in the Ganges after death will break this cycle of reincarnation and help them achieve moksha, or eternal liberation. But that's not the only problem faced by those who are desperately trying to clean up a river that is considered the most sacred by Hindus. Journalist Cameron Conway has been reporting on the state of the Ganges, and we found his article, "The Ganges River is Dying Under the Weight of Modern India." That was at Newsweek. Cameron, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So I guess at the heart of this belief in Ganga, the Hindu goddess believed to be the personification of the Ganges. What can you tell us about how that influences how the Ganges is treated today?
Sure. So, yeah, I think it's important to note that there is a separation here. So there is Ganges, the river, and that is the body of water, right? But most Indians, they view it as the Ganga first. So it's the self-cleaning river god. It's the mythological story of the river that lived in heaven, but chose to come to earth to purify their souls. And it's a very elaborate, gorgeous story.
So self-cleaning, explain that. Do they believe that they can pollute it as much as possible and it will just clean itself?
Yes.
Wow.
This is a large part of the problem in terms of the pollution caused by the people themselves. But it's also this idea has infiltrated the politics and has made it very difficult to pass any kind of legislation whereby people can be blamed and held responsible for what they're doing to the river.
So what are the main sources of pollution of the river?
I think industry and business are the most severe sources of pollution. There are huge hotel organizations like the Radisson Blue that pump their chemicals into the Ganga without having really to answer to anybody. And so businesses kind of across the board are able to do this. It seems that things are tightening up and there is a little more awareness towards this, but really, I mean, they're able to pump all of their waste product right into the river.
And waste product includes human waste in this case.
Yeah, right. So they don't have to pay to have their waste product cleaned. And then just the chemicals that they use, they can just drain it all in. And yeah, I mean, that just has disastrous consequences.
So millions of gallons of industrial effluents, raw sewage draining into the Ganges every day. Any idea of how much this actually costs the nation in terms of disease, for example, or the inability to use the water and need other sources?
You know, there hasn't been a definitive study that can compile all of those, you know, myriad influences together into a single figure. But this belief in the river is so pervasive that, you know, people believe that nobody gets sick and nobody dies from the consequences of what's happening. And it's just simply not true. I mean, there are 600,000 Indians a year living along the Ganges River Basin that die just from diarrhea. And I would argue that most of those cases can be directly contributed to the water situation.
Well, the major sources for this pollution are often believed to be from the poor and the vulnerable who live
right
along the banks. You point out that the data does not bear that out. What's the story here?
Yeah, so everybody I researched, you know, they said it's human nature and it's so much easier to see a figure such as, 600 million people in India do not use toilets, or, you know, I think it's 45% of Indians have a cell phone, but 31% have a toilet. So it's sort of easy to visualize, wow, that's a lot of waste product just being pumped into the river. And so then you end up blaming the people who live along the river, which in some sense, you know, does need to happen, that is contributing. But everybody that I talked to said, yeah, but that's such a small percentage of what's actually happening here. It's really the businesses just pumping millions of gallons of effluent right into the river that's the true problem here.
Are there different areas where the pollution is worse, better along the path of the Ganges?
So, yes, in Varanasi, you know, the city of learning and burning, as it's often called, there are so many religious festivals there. And the result of that is that, you know, this is where more people view the Ganges River as Ganga, and so pollution just skyrockets. However, then I went up north in Rishikesh, and it's a whole different ballgame. I actually was able to get in the water, and there was a period of, you know, 30 minutes or so where I didn't see any trash. So I think there are some regions where they're figuring it out. They're figuring out how to keep this river clean despite the booming population. And I think they're on to something that really needs to take root in the rest of India.
We're speaking with Cameron Conaway. He's a reporter who's been doing some work on the Ganges River, which is horribly polluted. And Cameron, that seems like a story that we've been hearing for a long time, that the Ganges is polluted. But now the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, has made cleaning the Ganges a passion project and says he's going to clean the river by October 2019. That's the anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi's birth. So, first of all, how realistic is that?
It's not realistic whatsoever.
Is this just political?
I really think it is. You know, I had high hopes, and a lot of the people that I interviewed, researchers at different universities, they did as well. I've seen that hope start to wane a bit. But, you know, Modi was just in Silicon Valley. I mean, there was a, you know, hashtag Modi in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. hashtag Wired India. And I think it really upset a lot of people. There was a journalist, Sanam Sharma, who wrote for The Huffington Post, Modi is selling a dream, but we're living a nightmare. And, you know, what does it matter if you have Wi-Fi everywhere, if you don't have a sustainable, clean source of water in your country? And so that was what I was trying to get at here with this story.
So what's his plan? What's his strategy for pulling this off?
I think the big strategy for him has been this toilets before temples mantra that he's really been pushing it. And it's just a beautiful alliteration and it's really catching on. But again, the research is panning out. I mean, some of the places that I went in India, I'm seeing 50, 60 toilets just sitting there. They have been donated by people. You know, if you build it, doesn't mean they will come. There's no education. A lot of the people actually think that using a toilet is more unsanitary. So it's just not part of their culture. So I really think there needs to be a cultural shift. And it's very hard for me to say that as an outsider, obviously. But from what I've seen and people I've talked to, this seems to be the belief of what needs to happen.
Any signs of improvement so far since Modi made this toilets before temples plan?
You know, I think the one important shift that's happened is there just were not a lot of toilets in schools. And so I really think it's helping to shore up some of the gender issues happening in India. So they've really made sure that, you know, the girls have a clean toilet to go to and that they don't have to walk too far to get there. So, I mean, that's absolutely been a positive. To say that that's had an impact on the cleanliness of the river, I'm not so sure.
How about technology? I mean, there are ways that rivers can be cleaned with filtering, with technological solutions. Is that happening there?
It is, yeah. I mean, they look like monsters, some of these machines. They look like, you know, something that landed from Mars. And they're cleaning the surface level of the water, so they're able to pick up the, you know, the plastic bottles and those kind of things. But even the research that's happening there, a lot of other people will cite a 1896 study from a British bacteriologist and then a 1916 study from a Canadian microbiologist that said, hey, you know, the mythology that we believe in, that the Ganges River can clean itself, it's actually true. These two researchers proved it. So, yeah, I mean, it's this kind of battle between religion in a lot of ways and then rational thought. And I've just been fascinated by it for years.
You know, you talked about changing the mindset around toilets, but trying to convince people who believe the river is this omnipotent force that you can continue discarding trash and toxic waste in the river, replacing dead bodies will not harm the river. What can be done to actually change that mindset? And again, of course, you are a Western journalist looking at, you know, how things have been thought about in another place. There's a lot of sensitivity to that.
There is. And you know, the story that I wrote here has been told countless times, and there hasn't been any significant changes made. So clearly, a Westerner coming in and telling the story again, no matter how well, it's not going to change anything. But what I noticed and what I really wanted to emphasize in the story was a lot of religious leaders in India are coming together and they're realizing that at the heart of it, Hinduism and any religion is about story. It's about the power of story. And so they're learning to reframe Hindu mythology around the Ganga River in the context of, you know, you can't harm the river by putting stuff in it, but you can harm everything that relies upon the river. So that plastic bottle gets broken down a little bit and a cow, you know, licks it up and chokes on that. And that has actually happened. So it's linking those two sacred elements of the cow and the river in the context of a story. And so that is a large reason why actually the river is much more clean in Rishikesh than other places, because they have a kind of interfaith dialogue really pushing that agenda.
Cameron, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Cameron Conaway, he's a former MMA fighter, an award-winning poet, and a journalist. He's been reporting on the state of the Ganges River with the support of a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And we found his article at Newsweek, and you can read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. There are some who argue that fresh water, not oil, will be the focus of the world's next big resource crisis. One man in California, a state now facing its own critical water shortage, is looking to the clouds for an answer, quite literally. Lila Day reports.
John Lavelle is holding onto a rope, easing himself down a steep drop-off.
I've already fallen off of it once.
He's looking down a canyon called Avalon in Daly City. It's a gusty place with planes constantly overhead. He's here to check on his harvest.
People ask me, what do I do? And I say, harvest fog, and they go, harvest frog?
Lavelle is a fog harvester. He's obsessed with it.
Light fog, heavy fog, moderate fog.
And the water that's floating right over our heads. He points to a little white fluffy cloud.
This, like, chunky one right here, that's probably 100 or 200 elephant weight. And so that's probably 80 to 90,000 gallons of water.
Elephants. That's how some researchers measure the weight of a cloud. Let's say the density of a cloud is 500 million grams of water, or 1.1 million pounds, and its volume is about a billion cubic meters. Multiply those numbers together, and it starts to get hard to wrap your head around. Therefore, elephants, which can weigh about 4 tons. So that little puffy cloud that we're looking at right now is about 100 of them. That's a lot of water in the sky. Millions of elephants overhead as far as the eye can see. And then there's the fog.
Fog's a lazy cloud. Decides not to get up. No, it's heavier water droplet sizes that don't get pulled up by an updraft. So it goes across countrysides, it goes coming in from the ocean.
I follow Lavelle down the side of a cliff.
Go down face first. Australian style.
We reach a plateau area. We're at the harvesting site. The design is actually not that complicated. There are 4 rectangular panels in an area of about 50 feet. They're raised up 10 feet high by a metal stand. It kind of looks like solar panels. One surface of each panel is covered with a mesh grid, angled towards the sea. The fog gets trapped in the mesh as condensation and drips down through plastic tubes into blue containers sitting on the ground. Lavelle points at one of the containers.
Go ahead, pick it up.
I pick up the blue bucket. It's full of water.
That's 26 and a half liters, so 7 gallons.
Lavelle comes down here daily to check these buckets, and if his calculations are right, he's averaging about a gallon of water an hour per panel when there's heavy fog. He thinks that placing 50 of these panels in a place with frequent heavy fog could yield about 5,000 gallons of water a day. But the water collected by the fog harvesting mesh isn't drinkable. Most likely, you'll get sick.
Well, you get a lot of bacteria off the ocean fog. It's full of life. So it carries in little critters.
Lavelle says that's okay. There's other important uses for this water.
Right now, we're at agricultural level. This for the vineyards and other agricultural endeavors. If they have fog on their property, this is going to be a way to get water in viable amounts over a long period of time.
Lavelle wasn't always a fog harvester. He used to be a carpenter. He says there was a moment a couple years ago that started him on this path. He happened upon a TED Talk online given by architect Michael Pollan.
It may come as a surprise to some of you to hear that quite large areas of what are currently desert were actually forested a fairly short time ago. And during the evolution of life on the Earth, it was the colonization of the land by plants that helped create the benign climate we currently enjoy. The converse is also true. The more vegetation we lose, the more that's likely to exacerbate climate change and lead to further desertification.
After hearing that TED Talk, the world's water issues weighed heavy on Lavelle's mind. He became angry at the lack of attention on the water crisis that affects so many countries around the globe.
We live on a planet that's 70% water, and we have 2.5 billion people living on 2 liters of water a day. And for people to say, oh yeah, that's terrible, I say try it. I did.
Lavelle tried an experiment on himself. For a few days, he attempted to live like many people do around the world, places where water is scarce.
I had to figure out a place to go. I had to figure out a place to get my water. And then I duplicated an hour and a half of walking. Women spend 200 million hours a day gathering water.
But empathy wasn't enough. Lavelle wanted to find solutions. He heard about a company in Boston doing research on condensation, a place called MBD Nanotechnologies. So he called them up and told them he wanted to be involved in some way. And with Lavelle being in the ideal location for testing fog, the Northern California coast, they decided to ask him to facilitate their first pilot program, even though he's not a scientist.
I'm on a learning curve on the research of this. I've read a ton of stuff, and there's a ton of stuff more to read. But actually being out here in the field, I'm getting a hands-on experience.
Lavelle asked friends to help build the fog harvesting structures, and MBD agreed to assist with the technology needed to record his data. I met the team from MBD when they flew in from Boston to do a site visit.
What we're trying to do is offer an alternative solution that is environmentally friendly and not harsh for the environment around it, but actually takes advantage of what's naturally in the environment here in San Francisco, which is these heavy fogs that you see rolling over the bay on a daily basis.
That's Deckard Sorensen, president of MBD. He started his company in 2013 to research sustainable solutions for the world's water crisis. Since then, the company has gained the interest of private investors to the tune of over $5 million. When I ask Sorensen about the yields they've measured from the fog harvest, he says it's still in a testing phase and doesn't want to give me this info yet. But the scientists at MBD think that successful fog harvesting could actually help solve the world's water problems. Here's senior scientist Sarah Biani.
We're all about making a positive impact. Hopefully, you know, the positive impact will be resonating globally.
Although this is MBD's first fog harvesting project, this kind of research has been going on since the 1980s. At least 17 nations have experimented with some type of application to convert fog into water. But so far, fog harvesting has not appeared to be a viable large-scale solution to water shortages. According to some scientists, fog collecting can be helpful for rural areas in underdeveloped countries, but the average water consumption in the developed world is too high for something like fog harvesting to make a dent. Plus, fog is unpredictable. Sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't. Some scientists also say fog harvesting would be more successful with more effective materials. MBD has designed a new kind of mesh for their fog panels, one that they believe is creating higher yields. It's working great on Lavelle's fog harvester.
We have noticed no wash off of our material so far into the water. So whatever the fog is carrying in it is what's going into the reception container.
Eventually, Lavelle and the scientists at MBD think that these types of fog catchers can be used on a much larger scale. Today, there's no fog in sight. But that doesn't discourage John Lavelle, though he lives way up the coast in Fort Bragg.
I'm down here all the time with this. I have to check on it. I can't abandon it.
For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Howard Axelrod was in a small cabin in Vermont when thousands of protesters descended on the WTO meeting in Seattle. He was there without a cell phone, computer, or television for the bombing of the USS Cole, the Y2K panic, and the Supreme Court's Bush v. Gore decision. Howard went into the woods not to live deliberately, as Thoreau did. He didn't need a break from technology or a writing retreat. It was 5 years after a freak accident left him without sight in one eye, a loss that changed his vision of the future and ignited his wanderlust. The few years of traveling and broken love behind him, Howard needed, he writes, to live without putting on a face for anyone, including myself. The Point of Vanishing is Howard Axelrod's memoir of living in solitude for almost 2 years. And Howard Axelrod, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you were a junior at Harvard when this accident at a pickup basketball game left you without sight in your right eye. What kind of future were you imagining for yourself back then?
I hadn't wanted to imagine a future too much because the track that I was on led to law school, and that wasn't something that gave me great joy to think about. The accident happened right at the end of my junior year. I was pretty much a straight-A student, and I knew I needed to start to figure out, as my classmates were starting to figure out, where I was headed, what I wanted to do, what was important to me. But the track led to law school. My father's a lawyer. My uncle's a lawyer. My brother was heading towards law school. My cousin's a lawyer. It's basically the family business, and I got knocked off that track. So I was playing basketball in a pickup game. I had played high school basketball. I played a lot of basketball as a kid, and it was right before finals, as I said, so I went to play basketball just as a way to relax. The basketball court was a place where I felt very at home, where I felt very much myself, and it was just a freak accident. There was a loose ball. It was a rebound, and a boy's finger went into my eye, and it went in quite deeply. It curved around the eyeball and disconnected the optic nerve, which is the cable that runs from the back of the eye to the brain. So with that connection severed, I was blind in my right eye.
Mm. Well, the loss of the sight and of depth perception as well, your other senses begin to compensate. You build up what you call your spidey senses. How? What are some of those ways that other things took over?
That's right, my spidey senses. So after you lose vision in one eye or vision in both eyes, studies have shown that I think within a week of the loss of vision, your brain starts to adapt and it starts to take information from the auditory part of your brain and connect those neurons to the visual part of your brain so that you can start to orient not just through what you're seeing or what you are no longer seeing, but through what you're hearing. And the information from what you're hearing goes to the visual part of your brain so that you can start to see in some way what you're hearing. So that happened without my trying to do anything. That was just an adaptation that my brain was doing for me. But I did become aware that my hearing was more acute and that I was orienting in space in part based on what I was hearing. But then there were other ways in which I was trying to adjust consciously. I would walk up to class later because, as you mentioned, I lost some peripheral vision on my right-hand side. So I found I was bumping into people a lot. Also, with the loss of depth perception, it was sometimes hard to know how far away I was from someone or something. So I just tried to give myself more space and to be in places that weren't quite as crowded and to make sure I was seeing as much as possible. So, for instance, I would sit in the back of the class, always all the way on the right, because then I wouldn't have to worry about peripheral vision on the right-hand side, and I would have the whole room in front of me.
Well, you gave yourself a lot of space by going from that environment to a couple of road trips across the country, some time spent in Italy and Bologna, and that led you to this one-year rental in a cabin in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. And once there, your sensual experience of the world changes dramatically. You know, you write about being attuned to the wind on your face, how your voice sounded craggy and strange without use, and you observe that in the woods, there is no sound that wasn't useful. Were you looking for silence?
Yes. I think what I was looking for most was a kind of compensation or alternative for the depth perception that I lost. So with the loss of vision in one eye, it becomes hard to perceive depth. We perceive depth based on the information going into one eye, and then the brain triangulates that information with the information going in the other eye, so we know where objects are located in space. But so without vision in both eyes, I lost that. And by being in the woods, as we were talking about before, I could focus more on my hearing. So that's another way to orient in space, not just spatially, but also with the benefits of everything that I could hear. But then another way that I think I was looking for was to be someplace where I was aware of time, because that's another kind of dimensionality, not just spatial, but temporal. And by being in the woods, I could see the stars every night, at least when it wasn't cloudy, and I was aware of the mountains. And so I became more aware of the capital T type time, not clock time, but geological time, astronomical time. And having that kind of awareness, it was another version of, I guess, sitting as far back in the classroom as I could, sort of like sitting as far back in life as you can, to have the deepest or the widest kind of perspective possible. So that's it, it's not so much that I was looking for silence per se. I was just looking for a way to reorient myself through my senses and to use all of my senses to help give myself another kind of depth as a replacement for the kind of depth perception that I'd lost.
Well, it's interesting because there seems to be this kind of conflicted self of being visible or being invisible. You know, here you are in this cabin at the end of a dead-end road, you know, way out in the woods. You have contact with very few people, Nat, your plow guy. There's a woman and her very attractive teenage daughter who run a restaurant in town. Even those people, you kind of want to reach out to, but something keeps you from it. What?
Well, I think that divide between visible and invisible corresponds with a divide that I felt acutely after the accident, which was a divide between my inner life and my outer life. After the accident, once all the blood dissipated and the swelling went away, my right eye actually looked the same as my left for quite a while. So outwardly, I looked the same. I told my friends about the accident, but a lot of people didn't know. But meanwhile, the world looked different to me. Depth perception was gone and peripheral vision had changed. So outwardly, I could maintain that track that I'd been on, the all-around student who was on his way maybe to law school. But meanwhile, inwardly, all the questions about the nature of reality and what I could trust and who I was and who I was going to become only became more immediate and more urgent. So by being in the woods, it was a way of letting go of that outward part of myself, of not having to fulfill any roles for anybody else, not having to put on any masks, and letting go of all the parts of my identity that came from fulfilling those roles. And the question was, if I dropped all of those roles that I played for other people, what would be there? And that, of course, tends towards the invisible. But it's not that I wanted to be invisible. I just wanted to try to get to the more interior part of myself and live from there, orient from there.
We're speaking with Howard Axelrod. He is the author of the new memoir, The Point of Vanishing. It's about living in solitude in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom for almost 2 years. Now, this was following an accident when he lost sight in one eye. So I guess he was looking for an orientation that he could trust the natural world. You know, your family doesn't know quite what to think. Somebody, maybe it was your cousin or your brother, calls you the Unabomber when you resurface at a family Thanksgiving. They compare you to Chris McCandless of that Into the Wild, that book fame. I couldn't help thinking of that movie Vanishing Point. But even if you don't know that, there is this kind of, you know, vision of American maleness as the loner who doesn't need or want anybody else or who's escaping something. And I wonder how you see your years of solitude in comparison with this kind of untouchable male who needs nobody else.
I think in some ways I was following in that tradition. I suppose it's not as though I fashioned myself after Thoreau, who in fact spent a lot of time with other people and apparently was going to his mom's back window to get peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and who was really hardly a hermit. But that is a part of the American tradition, or at least the American mythos. And I was a strange combination in that I was very confident still, but I was also very lost. And so I had this sense that I could figure out the answers for myself. I also had the sense that at first that heading west, which is so American, heading west into big open spaces would help me find those answers. And then ultimately retreating into the woods and into solitude would help me. And that impulse may be less American than, say, Eastern. You can find parallels in a lot of different cultures where there's retreat to solitude, to silence. I did a reading the other night at this nature center in Connecticut, and there was a sign on the wall. It was an owl, and it says there was a wise owl who lived in an oak. The more he saw, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't we be like that wise old bird? So, I mean, I don't know if that's the owl tradition or what, but I certainly appreciated that idea of the more he saw, the less he spoke. And then also the less he spoke, the more he heard. You know, what that is when we decide to try to turn down the noise of daily life and get away from it, escape from it, certainly, but also use it as a way of searching to hear something else, something deeper inside of ourselves, but then also in the natural world. And then from there, ideally, to have a way to return. So there's an ability to hear more, to pay attention better with other people.
You did have a couple of forays back into the socialized world, one on Thanksgiving in a New York town. You almost got arrested. I'm going to leave that to readers to find out. But also, you went to Cambridge, your old stomping grounds, and you felt like a wild animal who'd wandered into a zoo. So why did you decide to go back to the city?
So those first forays back were extremely difficult. I was ill-prepared. To go back to our friend Thoreau, he said that all his time in solitude or quasi-solitude made him more eager for company but less fit for it. Hmm. And that's certainly what happened with me. I felt as though, oh, now I've learned to be more attentive and to listen in a different way and to be so appreciative of another person's existence, the way you might wonder at a deer or a bird if you hadn't seen any movement for quite a while. But then I came back into the city and was just overwhelmed, felt bombarded by sirens and taxi breaks. And so that didn't work out too well. And as a preview, it made me think maybe I shouldn't come back at all. But as I spent more time in the woods and that second winter grew deeper and deeper, I felt myself being pulled towards that sense of losing the self, towards being more like the wind and the snow. And ultimately that becomes dangerous. I mean, it may sound pleasant if you're studying Zen, but certainly if you're a psychologist or a psychiatrist, it's a warning sign. And for me, I didn't recognize the warning signs for a while, and then eventually it became clear. I had a dream one night that I had killed someone, and I didn't know who I had killed, and I didn't know where the body was, but I needed to hide the body. And I was in my high school, the high school where I went as a kid, and eventually, I found the body stashed in a locker. And of course, when I opened the locker door, the body was mine. The face was mine. And and the dream was terrifying. I mean, it was to recognize, it couldn't have been more obvious. I guess maybe my subconscious was saying, listen, we're going to make it really clear for you. We don't want you to miss this one. Pay attention. This is getting dangerous. And indeed, it was. I mean, I'm a pretty slender guy, and I weigh 155 pounds now, and when I came out of the woods, I was 120. Mm. I mean, I just hadn't been eating very well, and I was, in a lot of ways, tending towards non-existence. So ultimately, there was a realization that if I were to keep living that way, that was going to become my life. I was going to lose, even if I didn't die, just by living in the woods like that, I was going to lose my connections to my friends and to my family and to my past.
Well, Howard, I know that when we were arranging for you to come to the studio and talk to us today, we were told that you don't have a cell phone. I wonder how you're getting on in this, you know, you live in an urban area, you live in the Boston area, you don't have a cell phone. How do you connect with all your friends for those beautiful occasions?
So I do have a landline, and my friends are welcome to call me on my landline. The ringer is off and off when I'm writing, but they're welcome to leave a voicemail message. And I never did have a cell phone, but I don't feel any impulse towards having a cell phone. Just driving here, actually, to come to the studio, I got a little lost. And I suppose if I had a GPS, that would have helped. But so I pulled into a gas station, and there was a man out front working on a car. And I said, listen, I have to be at the studio in 10 minutes. Can you help me? And he told me where to go, and he smiled at me, and I got here. You know, so there are other ways of getting around, or even if you get lost, finding your way. And I don't know, Facebook, Tinder, I'm not really curious to see what's happening by the minute. I think that if we take more time with our experiences and we're more present wherever we are, then when we actually meet up with other people or have phone conversations with other people, we'll have a lot more to offer rather than just, here's a snapshot of the sangria I had last night at the Mexican restaurant. I don't know why that would really be interesting to anyone to share or to hear about. So I think it's okay. Friends sometimes get annoyed if they're late to meet me and they wanted to tell me they were late and that I didn't have a phone, but I don't mind waiting. So then I just tell them it's fine. If you're 15 minutes late, I don't care.
Well, Howard Axelrod, thank you for finding your way to the studio and speaking with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Howard Axelrod, he teaches at Grub Street, and he's the author of The Point of Vanishing, a memoir of 2 years in solitude. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Please let us know what you think about some of the issues that were raised. Do you believe that recycling isn't really helping the planet? Will 20 years worth of study and new data change your recycling habits? Maybe give you a sigh of relief? And what are the implications of water scarcity and protection and possibly privatization? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. Now, you're listening on the weekend. If you can't catch us during the weekday, you can subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend, or better yet, rate it. That'll help others to find us. And as we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.